This is Coda Radio, episode 564 for April 2nd, 2024. Hey friend, welcome into Jupiter Broadcasting's weekly talk show, taking a pragmatic look at the art and the business of software development and the world of technology. My name is Chris, and joining us, like he does every single week, it's our host, Mr. Dominic. Hello, Mike.
Okay, hey, don't touch that debris, okay?
It's hot.
You know, well, it's hot, and you know, I'm down here under fire, so to speak, in Space's landfill, the great state of Florida.
It really is. Why does space junk fall on Florida?
Well, to be fair, we launch a lot of stuff into space.
That's true.
Canaveral. Yeah.
It might be space karma. It's space karma, you know?
I have some Alpha Centauri bacon already right at the top of the show.
Oh, I like it. I'm glad. I brought the bacon.
Oh, yeah. That's some good.
Alpha Centauri bacon.
Yeah, so apparently we are getting bombarded with trash from the International Space Station.
Yeah.
Here in the great state of Florida, which literally makes us space's landfill.
Quote, tore through the roof and both floors of a two-story house in Naples, Florida, right past the guy's son, the one room over the guy's son, and a piece of space metal junk from, and why is the ISS just dropping space junk? I don't know. Chunks of metal, too. You know, they just want to get it figured out. It's probably so he knows who to sue.
Here's a hint. Don't sue the Russians. They're not going to pay you. And next time you have a cup of tea, it may be a little, radioactively spicy.
I have a local interest story for you. So that's the Florida story. Here in the Pacific Northwest, today we realized that AI actually stands for Automated Indians, not artificial intelligence. It turns out, you probably heard about this Just Walk Out store that Amazon's started here in Seattle, where you walk in, you pick up the stuff you want, and then you walk out, and they use AI and all of that and image recognition to figure out what you bought, and then they charge you later. Well, turns out, wasn't completely automated. Just Walk Out relied on more than 1,000 people in India watching and labeling the videos to ensure accurate checkouts. The whole thing was a scam. Maybe some of it wasn't, but this whole like Amazon grocery stores where they don't have checkout, it was all a joke. It was a bunch of Indians in a call center somewhere watching you on video the whole time.
It reminds me of the very sad end of that Silicon Valley episode where they get the fake users and they just go to the click farm in Bangalore.
Right. Or you might recall that semi-truck truck company that demoed semi-trucks, but it was really, it was because they were like going downhill and didn't even have active motors in them. it'd be one thing for like a tiny startup, you know, that's one thing. But for Amazon, you know, Amazon, that's a whole other level. And how much hype did they generate? You know, how much like future forward looking, you know, did they look?
What was it like mainstream, like Good Morning America had them on it, right?
Oh, yeah.
It
was a tourist trap
here
in Seattle. You know, if you're in Seattle, you got to go check out the Amazon store. It doesn't have a checkout line.
Oh, Lord.
The idea is kind of fun. I kind of like it. You know, you get down there, you pick out some, you know, you're on your, say you live in the city life. You're walking to your office, you're walking to your work. You swing in through the Amazon automated Indian store, you pick up yourself a lunch, and you walk right out. You know, you don't have to talk to nobody. You could leave your headphones in, listening to your podcast. It's antisocial, which, you know, our generation loves. And you maybe don't even get charged, you know, depending on what the camera did or didn't see. Amazing. Coder.show/membership. Go over there and sign up, you know? I don't know. I wish I wasn't doing this spot. This spot could be available for you if you're listening and you got a little marketing budget. You know, you could out sponsor the old Coder program so you don't have to listen to me do the in-house ad here. But actually, coder.show/membership, it's pretty neat. Some lunatic created the Jar Jar promo code. Wasn't me. Takes $2 off for the lifetime of your membership. I believe we have 3 more redemptions left. And then finally, I have crushed this insurrection. but we got some great signups last week. Shout out to Robert and Lewis and Brad and Andrew and Travis. And I'm going to say Arjo for signing up. Those are our new members after last week's episode. And also, I'll give a shout out to Anthony. I think it was Anthony who signed up just a little bit before the episode. So before I even reminded Anthony. And of course, a shout out to Lewis and Andrew, who are paying above the Jar Jar discount. What? So if you want to get the Jar Jar discount, there's like three redemptions left. The Coda program is currently 100% supported by our audience, which I love. You know, if you could make this work full time, you know, as a podcaster, if I could make it work full time, I'd do it. It's great being sponsored by the audience. It's fantastic because, A, it saves me a ton of time on the back end. It means we never really have to worry about any kind of appearance of bias. Even if we can try to remain absolutely unbiased, I think it still can cause an appearance, especially to a new listener who doesn't know us yet. Where having an audience-funded show, you just resolve all of that. You always know our only goal is to make you the most informed and entertained as possible. We're not selling it to somebody else. I think we've always walked a pretty good line on this show, so I don't really think it's been a big problem, but it's pure, it's clean, and it's really the only thing keeping us on the air right now. Coder.show/membership. You can sign up, use the promo code Jar Jar, take $2 off the lifetime cost, or you can support each production by sending a boost into the show. NewPodcastApps.com. I really like Fountain, Podverse, and Castomatic. Those are like my top apps right now. You put some sats in there. Strike, I think, is one of the best ways to do that. It's run by a really solid group of people. It's on the Lightning Network already. It's a great company, a great app, simple, clean, gets you those sats. You send them over to your app of choice, maybe Fountain, and you start boosting. Send a message, send some value. It's a great way to support each individual production. And also, it's one of our favorite segments in the show because it's all improv. It's whatever you guys want to talk about. It's a couple of open ways to do it. And then, of course, there's the membership, which is that nice base run rate that we can always count on. Coder.show/a membership. Go use that insurrectionist promo code created by some spy inside the organization. Promo code Jar Jar. Coder.show/membership. Thank you, everybody. And thank you to our new members who signed up. Really appreciate that. Now back to the show.
We do have to pour one out, by the way.
Oh, what happened?
Well, our friend of the show, Sam Bakeman-Fried, 25 years in federal prison.
Yeah.
As I affectionately call it, federal pound me in the ass prison.
No kidding. Yeah, and that's going to be rough on a vegan.
A lot of sausage.
I don't know if you saw, but during the sentencing hearing, he had the shakes real bad.
Yeah.
And his lawyer asked if we could pause proceedings to jack him up with some Adderall. And the judge said, no, we're not going to stop so you can get him drugs.
Well, you know, it's harsh, but honestly, like, they wouldn't do it for anybody else.
Yeah. What it made me realize is that all of these individuals that were working at FTX and Alameda were all jacked up on speed the whole time. And I think there's something there. You know, they're part of their just unbelievable decadence. The fact that they thought they were unstoppable, that they'd never get caught. I think, you know, a heavy addiction to Adderall probably explains a lot of their behavior. What we witnessed was a speed-induced manic period of time. You combine that with the punch bowl getting spiked by the Fed. It just was the perfect recipe for just decadence. I watched that news unfold, and I was, I don't know, 25 years, it's harsh, but it seems like probably fair, too. And, you know, we'll see.
I mean, it okay, but, like, people go to jail for murder for less. We had this conversation last week. Yeah. I am not, like, the defender of Sam Bankman-Fried. In a lot of ways, he is the poster boy for everything I hate in the tech world, right?
Yeah.
I don't know, man. Like, if you could go to jail more for being a crypto, you know, jackass than a lot of people do for killing people, I feel like that's bad. Like, I don't, we just need overall reform. Having said that, real quick, it is unlikely he will actually serve 25 years.
Right. That's what I was going to say.
Like, the only thing I thought was a little scary, the whole thing is I would be terrified if I were him, but the judge seemed pretty adamant that he has no doubt that Sam Bankman-Fried would commit similar crimes again.
True.
Which is just a rough thing for a judge to say to you during sentencing.
Yeah, he had no moral compass, it seems.
Well, I mean, he said it, his stupid comment about, I would flip the coin every time, you know, whatever, if I could double humanity's success or whatever it was, or if the tail side was I destroy humanity. So, like, I feel like a lot of the punitiveness here was just his attitude kind of, I don't know. It just wasn't appropriate, or he didn't seem to. In a weird way, it just seemed like he felt he lost the video game, and it was like, whatever, I'll play another round.
I think the judge was probably right. I think it's going to be 10 years. I think he's going to get 10 years, and then they'll let him go. Good behavior, something like that. I mean, he has extremely affluent family. He paid off so many politicians. Once the public forgets, things will start getting a little easier for him, and then, you know, they'll reduce his sentence.
Well, and it's he's nonviolent, right? I mean, remember, anytime someone gets thrown in jail, us taxpayers are paying for it. So it's like, is this worth it?
I was going to ask you if you think maybe one of the reasons the judge did give him the full 25 is it does seem like we're still really going and prosecuting tech and tech adjacent crimes. Like, if your crime involves tech, you're screwed.
If he had gotten indicted, let's say four years ago, he probably would have gotten a lot less.
I also wonder, like, say he was running like some sort of Mary Kay style, but I guess Mary Kay might be legit. I don't know. But, you know, some sort of adjacent pyramid scheme where he's kind of doing some of these same shenanigans. Maybe it's at a smaller scale, but it's all, you know, paper and in real life based, going door to door like those scams used to be. Would they be throwing the same book at him? I don't think so. I think because it's a technology crime, which it also brings with it scale, like, we're still in this mindset of we have to punish him because it was a tech adjacent crime.
Well, and he has the unfortunateness of his attitude and his just love of being in public. I mean, let's be honest, if we were like Michael Eisenberg, I thought, was it Michael Eisenberg? I'm thinking, yeah, Michael Eisenberg, right? He played, I always confuse him and the guy who played Lex Luthor in that horrible Batman versus Superman movie.
Oh, yeah, right.
That's
yeah.
Mike, right, Michael Eisenberg. He was meant to be, you know, out of central casting, evil tech, evil Mark Zuckerberg. But Sam Bankman-Fried is literally, you could not, if you built it in a lab with the Cylons, you could not build a better evil tech guy. Which is ironic because he's really not a tech. Like, if you look at his skill set, he's actually just like in a weird way, he's just a gambler. Like, yes. He might have been better off running an illegal gambling parlor.
He was a gambler, yeah.
Right.
He was. He didn't do any of the development for FTX.
And he didn't know how to, right? It wasn't, he just like delegated it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So,
yeah. I think that's a fair point. He wasn't really a tech guy, but it was tech adjacent for sure.
But he looked, and he pretended to be one, and he wore the hoodies, and he played League of Legends or whatever it was. And
another bit of communication came out after the sentencing was announced. Another email, I don't know who got it, I don't know who leaked it, but it was a point-by-point plan by Sam, and in there, he delegates to someone, just go pick some left-wing politicians and throw money at them. We need to be on their good side. And I know there's been a lot of talk about how Sam gave money to the right and left, but he used dark money on the right. Fair enough. We still haven't seen documentation around that, but we have now seen multiple times it's been documented that he was intentionally, specifically buying off left, center-to-left, and very left politicians because it got him something. And you can see it in this email. It's like a bullet point of he essentially says, I don't care who you throw money at. Just make sure they're on the left and it gets us something back.
All true.
That to me, if they tell this story and during Sam's sentencing, there was a movie producer in the courtroom taking notes for supposedly some Hollywood production that may or may not be coming.
From a movie perspective, I think this is actually a more interesting story than even like Theranos, right? Because in a way, he's a lot less sympathetic than Elizabeth Holmes. Also, just the level of outrageous luxury while he was pretending to be this kind of ascetic monk-like dude.
Yes.
The hypocrisy there is gross. Like, Elizabeth Holmes, to her credit, she's like, I'm the next Steve Jobs. I want to be the next Steve Jobs. You will treat me as though I'm Steve Jobs. Right? Like, she was, for a scammer, she was in a weird way honest about what she was doing. Right? Like, what she wanted to be perceived as. This guy pretended to be living like a Shaolin monk or something. And sorry, I've been watching Walker Texas Ranger because I fell asleep with TV Land on. And he was really like chilling in mansions. Also, the thing about giving money to the Democrats, one of his escape plans that somehow he published or got leaked was he was going to go on Tucker Carlson, remember this? And declare that he'd come out of the closet come out of the closet as a Republican. I'm like, I'm glad none of that works, because you shouldn't be tried based on your political affiliation. Like, if you're
good point.
If you're guilty, you're guilty. Like, whether you're a liberal, a conservative, or a MAGA guy, or a progressive, yeah.
Oh man.
Also, Republicans have to come out of the closet. Do you have to like sit your parents down and have like a whole conversation? I didn't know that.
Mom, Dad, I don't know how to tell you this.
I know you had expectations of me volunteering for AOC. And you dreamed of the day that I would be a Democratic councilman.
But son, you hugged and kissed Maxine Waters. I don't understand.
But you love screwing with the EU. We thought, oh, that's a bipartisan activity. So
the EU.
There she is.
You know, so while we were in between shows, this whole XZ fiasco came out where there was a multi-year effort to take over the XZ Compression Library and Utils project, including multiple individuals that pressured the maintainer to burn out and hand over control. And so, you know, it's a moment for the industry to reflect, think about how they communicate with these projects, maybe how they approach these projects, and do better. So, of course, this morning, FFmpeg tweets that Microsoft has put their foot in the mouth and has completely not learned a single thing. They tweet, the XZ fiasco has shown how dependence on unpaid volunteers can cause major problems. Trillion-dollar corporations expect free and urgent support from volunteers. Microsoft Teams posted on a bug tracker full of volunteers that their issue was, quote, high priority. Here it reads. This is the issue that the Microsoft staff submitted to the bug tracker. Quote, hi. This is a high priority ticket, and the FFmpeg version is currently used is highly visible in a Microsoft product. We have customers experiencing issues with caption during Teams live event. Please help. Now, first of all, it's kind of arrogant for them to assume what is a high priority ticket to the project or not. It's sort of the project's determination. But also, if your trillion-dollar corporate product is having issues, maybe you should fix it and submit the patch to FFmpeg. Right.
or you could throw some money at it.
Right. And so they're telling this group of volunteers, here's a high priority issue for you. Go fix it. It's so gross. FFmpeg follows up. After politely requesting a support contract from Microsoft for long-term maintenance, they offered a one-time payment of a few thousand dollars. It's just unacceptable. We didn't make this up. And, you know, it's, I don't know, the lesson from this, all of these fiascos, but just most recently XZ fiasco, is that there needs to be an investment made by these companies. It's unsexy, it's lower down in the chain, and the person that recommends it to Microsoft, you know, the person that says, hey, we need to spend this money, they're not going to be able to put that on some sort of OKR that shows that their internal work did better, right? It's just going to be they didn't have thousands of customers get popped. I don't know how you sell that to an accountant or a manager who's trying to make their team look more lean and mean.
But this is a classic problem too, right? Like
100%
for like indie contractors or indie dev shops is your, I'm just going to make up a number here. Your, you know, $20,000 invoice seems really expensive, except if they actually look at their employees, what the alternative is, it's just even on like a, you know, quarterly run rate or 60-day run rate, it's so much more. But that's a sunk cost that they kind of, you know what I mean? They already have the staff, even if it's not as efficient. I'm sure Microsoft would see, like, let's be honest, right? Let's use my 20K number that I completely pulled out of the EU. I can imagine they would just never, like, call the FFmpeg people and be like, here's 20 grand. Can you get this done in a month? Like, that would require so many levels of approval.
Yes, yes.
Yet the employee who is like, you know, kind of effing off and maybe has some personal stuff and is taking all kinds of time, well, that's a sunk cost and it's okay. But yeah, the outside vendor, and I understand an open source project isn't really a vendor, but let's treat them like that for this case. You know, every invoice has to be scrutinized. Let's have a work, you know, a report of what you did. Like I used to do an old open source project, networking library for Battled Objective-C pre-ARC iOS. I ended up stopping support completely because I was appalled with literally competitors of mine using it, or people who were functionally competitors of me. And then I'm like, okay, well, you need to pay me, like, at the time I think it was charging like $145 an hour, $140 an hour. And it's like, you know, just like asking, oh, just pay me for 3 hours. No, this is open source. The ethos is for the community. Meanwhile, you're turning around and selling against me with your offshore developers. Yeah, huh. I have no patience for this stuff. Microsoft just needs, either they adopt the project internally and make their own competing project that's proprietary, or they pony up. I wouldn't do a damn thing if I was the FFmpeg team.
The thing that I wonder now is if I were Microsoft or Apple or Amazon or any of the, Google, any of these companies, do you, after this XE fiasco, do you have an internal conversation and that goes something like, well, if we ask them to do this work, how do we know an unpaid volunteer isn't going to slip a back door that eventually compromises our customers 2 years down the road? Whereas if they did the work, right, if Microsoft did the work and submitted the patch, they could audit internally. They could verify that it isn't, doesn't have anything malicious in there. I'm not saying this is the right way to think about it. I'm not saying it's how I think about it. But I do think it's possible risk-averse companies could start thinking about it this way.
I don't know. I think everybody's too used to the leveraging open source and paying nothing.
Mm. Yeah, it just feels like this just has got, something's got to break. Something's got to give. We got so lucky on this one, right? Because the attacker's intention, just based on the timeline, which, by the way, I have linked in the show notes, the timeline makes it clear that this was a multi-year effort. Multiple individuals or multiple accounts were involved in coordinating this. And then once they got access and control over the XE Utils repo, they went after Fedora and Debian to get it included in Fedora and Debian. Now, why? Because we are at a certain point in the development cycle where if they got it in Fedora 40 and they got it in Debian, it would be either in the next release of Fedora or the next release of Debian, which would then make it into Ubuntu, which would then make it into RHEL, then eventually Ubuntu LTS, and then we would have had a major problem. And this isn't just a bypass SSH login. This is actually a remote code execution. What's striking about it is it requires a very specific setup. First of all, it's a series of build time scripts that only apply if certain conditions are met. You're on an x86 box. You got glibc. You're on an RPM or deb system. And it checks to make sure you also don't have any like debug symbols loaded or anything like that. It checks all that and more. Then if you pass all those checks and you're building a package from the repo, like an RPM or a dev, then it inserts itself, but they just look like test files. It inserts itself, but then what it does is it only gets triggered on certain distributions that have patched OpenSSH to use systemd to load the compression library for them.
Oh, man.
So you got it's like all and not every distro does this. That's not even the recommended setup by the systemd team upstream. And they're actually working on a different way to load these compression modules. It's fascinating because somebody understood way, 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 way down the stack that if they attacked this XE library on these certain conditions, they could essentially get remote code execution on every Debian and Red Hat box if it got, you know, all the way downstream. And so then, so not only did they identify this tiny itsy bitsy cog at the bottom of the stack, it's not a flaw in SSH, it's not a flaw in systemd. But it requires all these things to come together. And so they identified that years ago, apparently, and then identified how to attack the core developer, the core maintainer. And they did this by one person just submitting a few innocuous patches that look really good. That's the primary attacker. They started with just submitting regular old nice-to-have patches that were easy and obvious to accept. And then somebody else comes along and submits a big old complicated patch. And then also, to kind of add insult to injury, a 1Password developer comes along and says, hey, how come XE for Java hasn't been taken care of in so long? What's going on here? Then another person jumps in. Oh, yeah, this place never gets maintained. This thing's basically abandoned. Their users are left out. Like, just really starts laid on thick for multiple different threads, burning and working this developer out. And then the person who's just been helpfully submitting innocuous patches, well, guess what? They're just there. Oh, I'm here. I could take over. Yeah, give me the control. I'll take over. Yeah, give me the domain. And then they start slipping in the good stuff. And this was a coordinated attack. I mean, the high-level picture that either a nation state or a set of individuals had here to understand the plumbing level here of how systemd loads this, how distributions patch this, how to do sanity check to make sure it works on certain distributions, which distributions to attack so it makes it into the long-term support and RHEL releases, and then how to go after that developer. Huge.
Huge, yeah.
It's pretty freaky, actually. When I think about it from that standpoint, and I feel like it does undermine some of the trust that risk-averse corporations are going to have in free software, and the only way they can get that trust back is if they start paying for people to contribute.
Well, wasn't this, I mean, our favorite foundation, the Linux Foundation, But wasn't this kind of the dream of the Linux Foundation, right? It was going to create a way to interface, you know, the open source community with corporate to get funding. And that kind of, can't say it hasn't happened, but it's, you know.
Doesn't it feel like after every one of these stories, we see some announcement about how corporations are taking us real serious and we've got this foundation for infrastructure and we're going to fund this. And then, you know, a year goes by and we have an even worse attack happen. Yeah. I could only imagine. I went back in time in my brain and I thought, imagine, Chris, 10 years ago trying to convince scared CTOs that they were going to get sued by SCO that this wasn't a problem, that this is actually open source found this and caught this before it was deployed widely. Imagine trying to convince somebody of that. What a losing battle that would have been.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
So, I mean, it goes back that if you follow the timeline, again, linked in the notes at coder.show/564, it goes back to 2021. October of 2021 is really when Giatan sends their first patch to the XE dev mailing list. And it's just real basic stuff. And then it leads pretty much all the way to last week in a series of events. I literally find it creepy and spooky. I don't think things are doomed. I don't think it's like an unsolvable problem, but it's definitely not one we have a ready solution for. And to take advantage and attack developer burnout, just for a moment, if we'll indulge ourselves and assume that maybe this was a nation state attack, if you just look at the coordination and the persistence, the depth of understanding here, well, what that suggests is that nation states have recognized developer burnout as an attack vector for free software.
Right. You put enough pressure on the devs, maybe they just get sloppy.
Yeah. And you get to maybe, or you just, you know, you create a problem for the dev, you offer a solution for the dev.
Yeah.
And that gives that individual more and more access and control over time. And you know, it raises a question of, has this happened before? And we just happen to get lucky because this Andreas guy happened to be running a very specific test environment. He happened to be testing on Debian SID, which was impacted by this at the time. And he happened to be trying to figure out some sort of like 500 millisecond CPU time getting eaten up by SSHD. And if he just hadn't been doing all of these things, it never would have been found. It wasn't like some automated scanner, some sophisticated enterprise security product didn't detect this. No firewall blocked this, right? No real-time, you know, threat detection, nothing. Millions and billions of dollars invested in that industry, and it was some dude messing around trying to figure out why SSH was eating up a little bit too much CPU and making things take too long. And because that just stuck in his craw, we found this. That's where we're at right now. It's a pretty vulnerable spot, and nothing's fixed, except for XE, of course. But like the core situation that enabled this is only going to get worse. It's only going to remain. And if nation states have identified this as an attack vector, that's a problem.
Well, and you have to think how many other projects are affected by stuff like this.
That's, you know, it's borderline scary. I mean, it's like, yeah, it's possible none. And it's possible many to several.
It seems deeply unlikely that it's none, but.
Yeah. 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 We're going to have to create. I don't know how you create tooling to find this. I really don't.
No. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, maybe Rust can solve it for us all.
Oh, boy.
I remember when Microsoft did this. But now Google has come out. And Google says that their teams are twice as productive than their C++ teams. How about that? Google reports that Rust shines in production to the point that developers are twice as productive using the language. This was at Rust Nation UK conference in London this week. A developer who's the director of engineering at Google, who works on the Android platform tools and libraries, described the experience as a huge boon and that they were migrating projects written in Go or C++ to Rust. And they recommended on stage to use Rust to extend reworking old code into that are non-memory safe languages into Rust to, say, rewrite C++ code, for example. And an internal survey at Google now shows a high confidence in the correctness of Rust code, with 85% of those surveyed believing it's more likely to be correct code than if it were in other languages. Well, I guess it's settled then, Mike.
I guess it is, huh? So we should RMR all our C++ projects and write them in Rust.
Yeah, boy. Can you imagine all these poor suckers out there that are using anything but Rust right now?
Oh, dude, they're just in a tough spot. Yeah. I hate these kind of posts. I hate when companies do this. it overemphasizes the tool and underemphasizes things like process and
skill
and keeping developers up to date and not super burned out. Because it gives the impression that switching to Rust is this magic bullet, right? That's going to make you amazing overnight, going to fix all your problems. It's really the same fallacy of, well, if we just rewrite this entire project.
Yeah.
But, you know.
And they love to do that. They love it. Well, whenever you have an excuse to throw out something that works and is almost feature complete and start over with something that is an MVP that barely has any features, give it to me. Anytime.
Obviously, we need to burn everything down. Right. It's so dumb. The irony is, like, last week or a couple weeks ago, they come out with this, whatever that new language was called, for C++ interoperability.
Yes. Was it just last episode?
We covered it last episode. So I'm kind of like, what? What do you guys? This is another case of Google, being so big they don't know. They're like the old Microsoft, right?
Yes.
Team A doesn't know what was it with the thing with the guns, right? All the Microsoft.
The right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing, kind of thing. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's ridiculous, and it's like we used to see a lot of stuff around this in terms of Swift, right? That everybody's like, oh, if I just rewrote this giant working money making iOS project in Swift. It's like, I don't think Swift is the reason, right? Objective-C is not the reason it's just like things get bigger and projects get more unwieldy. And it's a fallacy. It's a fallacy that people keep falling into.
So. I find the Rust evangelism, I mean, I'm a fan, obviously, but I find the evangelism, but I find it kind of perplexing, right? Because it really started, I don't know if you remember, because this is going way back, but we talked about it. 2016 Dropbox went all and on about how great Rust was. And that was early. Like, what? And then Figma in 2018. And then remember not too long ago, Microsoft came out saying, well, we're rewriting Windows internals and tools in Rust. We think it's a big deal. And then a couple of weeks ago, the White House came out and said, oh, memory safe languages, everybody should be using Rust. And now here comes Google. Like, they're so brave. Google.
The federal government is moving faster than you. You're in a great place.
I'm kind of skeptical like you. I mean, I'm a fan, but I'm also just a fan of using the tooling that works best for you, that you're most proficient in, that you can create something great in. Like, it doesn't need to be Rust. Okay, but let me ask you this. If somebody like, say, our kids were looking at getting into software development, in the next 5 to 10 years, because they're, they're in school right now. Mm-hmm. They want to start learning, maybe have a good career in 5, 6, 7, 8 years. Would it be horrible advice to tell them to learn Rust?
No, but it's not horrible advice to tell them to learn Python or C++ or whatever, right? Because ultimately, if you stick with it, the skills that really transfer over aren't knowing the language API.
Yeah.
It's just like knowing how to think in terms of like software architecture.
How to problem solve, how to architect things. Yes, yes, yes. You're so right. And maybe it'll be easier for them because they're going to have spatial personas. And I'm sure that'll be totally worked out now. In a surprising kind of preview before WWDC, perhaps indicating to us how much WWDC is going to be focused on AI, Apple is held, like they're one to do, very special press events with very blessed special press people, a special demonstration of what they're calling spatial personas, that give the Apple Vision Pro a, quote, less isolating experience. Up to 5 people can watch a movie or a TV show or play a game or collaborate inside your Apple Vision Pro. And Apple showed this demo through the system. So they contacted the press person or people, I don't know how many it was, and said, hey, we'd like to have a virtual meeting with you using Apple Vision Pro. So put on your headset and join us at this time. And during the demo, users could interact with other personas that were projected into their real environment, so into your room. You could even make eye contact with them, apparently. You can watch virtual screens together, each persona having their own perspective that's spatially correct. Certain tools work already, like JigSpace and Freeform, that allow users to work on 3D models and whiteboards together in real time. And then some games right now, like Hearts and a couple other, have like multiplayer experiences you can use to be in the same room together. And you basically look like a floating Star Wars holographic ghost without the blue shimmer. You know, it's sort of like semi-transparent and faded.
So you're a dead Hayden Christensen. Great.
You're a force spirit.
Yeah.
Somebody's head. I mean, that's what it looks like, though, right?
It does.
My question to you is, out of all of the issues Apple Vision Pro has to make it like a consumer-ready device, are you surprised this is the thing that Apple decided to bite off first?
I keep forgetting it exists, so.
Ooh.
Yeah. I mean, if anything, the more interesting part of the story to me is that they decided not to save this for Dub.
Yes.
So it tells me that I have a feeling they're going to have to give it some love, but I think they're going to back away slowly and start talking about how awesome their chips are for AI.
Yeah. I remember when all of the reviews were hitting, everybody kept talking about what a lonely experience it was. And I don't think I said anything on the show, but just knowing Apple and how they respond to the PR, that criticism to me when I was reading the reviews and watching Neelai.
Yeah.
That criticism is the one that stood out to me as like Apple's going to take the most seriously. They're not going to want people saying this is an isolating experience. That's why they put the eyes on the front of the stupid thing. That's why they have your head popping in when you walk up to it. And Apple put a lot of money and effort into making it a non-isolating experience. And then the first thing that everybody says is that it's a lonely, isolating experience. So, of course, this is what they're going to work on. It's what it would take. It's what it would take, like, for us to use it to do a show. Like, we always had joked about how great would it be to be in a virtual studio together. But we're not going to use it unless we can see each other, and it's useful. And I agree with you, sir. It is a sign that WWDC isn't going to focus much
on this. Yeah, they're going to jump on that AI train.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm already so burned out on it, though. Do you think they can make a... I mean, I'm cynical at this point. I mean, you've got the automated Indian story that we just talked about. You've got, like, ChatGPT, which to me feels like the shine's kind of worn off, and now it just sort of feels like a semi-useful tool. It's not, like, as revolutionary as everybody said it was going to be. I mean, the AI shine, I don't know, man. It's like... it's losing some of its appeal to me right now. Right is like, this is when Apple's going to go in hard a year late. They're like a year late to this game.
That's Apple's thing, right? Like, they always go in late, but they make it. I wouldn't mind Siri not sucking while I'm driving. So,
if they could attack a few specific use cases that end users would find useful, I suppose that would be worth it.
Yeah. I mean, the question is, WWDC is at least nominally a developer conference, right? What are the opportunities for developers here? I suspect the answer is not much.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Could they make somehow like an API that lets you just insert generated images into any app? Could they make, you know, text generation and text summarization and shortening just an API call away? So developers could start incorporating those things into their app without having to call out to OpenAI? That might just be useful on its own, right? If they just took some of that functionality and either moved it into iCloud or moved it into on-device processing, which would be even better, and then made that available to developers?
I mean, I think they're going to want to avoid anything that comes close to content creation, though, because of all the Apple hates bad press, right? So.
Yeah, you wouldn't want dick pics getting generated, right?
Yeah. Right.
Well, they'd have to, like, severely limit it. That's what they would do, is they would be very, very parental about it, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not as appealing. We'll see. We'll see.
And now, as the French say, it is time for le boost.
Well, let's do some boosts. And our first boost comes in from Max Power, who sent us 49,380 sats.
Hey, rich lobster!
Thank you, sir. You are our baller booster. And Max writes, hey, guys, just trying to do my part to support the coder. With a 4x4 Spaceballs boost, which if you add it up, this is some serious math here, that is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times 4, which means we're going straight to Plaid.
The hell was that? Spaceball 1. They've gone to Plaid.
Thank you, Max Power.
Nice.
And he also says that he's still waiting for you to buy an Apple Vision Pro.
Well, keep boosting.
Yeah, right. I think the odds are more on me right now than they are on you.
I think it's you. Yeah, I'm totally just... yeah,
because I'm still using my Quest 3, and I told myself that if I was, maybe I won't because I got a lot of travel coming up, but I told myself if I was still using the Quest by WWDC and they came out with some legitimately good productivity enhancing features to the Vision Pro, I would consider it. And for me, I would define that as being able to pull in multiple screens and not just one screen, maybe being able to run apps independently, Mac apps independently of being inside a screen. I don't know, something that makes it useful for me doing the shows, I would almost consider it then. So that's what I'm waiting to see. So Max Power, maybe you should be betting on me. I don't know, though. Sometimes you come in with those curveballs.
That's true.
You know, so actually, the odds are probably better on you, but we'll see. We'll see.
Ooh.
Rotted Mood has our second baller boost this week, 20,000 cents.
I hoard that which your kind covet.
No message, though. He's just sending him some support, which we always really appreciate. Adversary 17 coming in as one of our reliable boosters with 16,384 sats. He says, hey, Mike, I guess that upgrade you did went off the rails a bit.
Oh.
He says, I know where the door is. I'll see myself out.
Wow.
It's good enough. It made me laugh twice. Appreciate it. Thanks for the support, adversaries. Listener Jeff comes in with 5,000 sats.
Coming in hot with the boost.
No ads? Boost. Thank you. Yeah, we do need it.
Boost.
That is true. Cultivator came in with 3,333 sats. No message, just a lucky row of 333. Thank you, sir. Appreciate that. Sam Squanch comes in with a bleep bloop.
B-O-O-S-T.
Support us with 10,000 sats. Thank you, sir. And No Joe's came in just before we went on air. Just before we went on air, so I really appreciate that. With 10,000 sats.
Make it so.
Says, I enjoy the show. Keep up the great work. And it's a shame Mike won't be joining us at Texas Linux Fest. Oh, no, Mike made it. He's just shaking off a hangover back in his hotel room. He's actually here. He is here.
I am?
At Texas Linux Fest. That's going to be my answer. I'm just practicing when I'm in Austin. That's what I'm going to tell people. Oh, Mike, no, he made it. Yeah, oh, he's here. Yeah, I mean, he's crashed back in his hotel room, but he totally made it to Texas.
The worst part is many people will believe you.
I know. That's what's so great about it. I mean, I'm only half kidding. I'm mostly kidding, but it would probably work.
No, you know, you could say Mike got hit by some space debris. He's laid up for a few days.
They'd also believe that.
And then an alligator ate his leg.
Thank you, everybody who boosted, and we had 8 boosters, and we stacked 114,307 sats. Appreciate you.
B-O-O-S-T.
If you'd like to support this production, go get a new podcast app and try it out. A whole bunch of new features are in there, like Fountain FM, Castomatic, or Podverse, including you get the release 90 seconds after we post it, transcripts, chapters, and boosting, amongst other things. And in the future, the live stream will be right there in the app as well. A lot of good stuff to play around with. It's finally moving podcasting forward, trying to compete with the likes of YouTube, Apple, and Spotify by bringing those features into the podcast app, but doing it in a standardized way. There's like just under all it really is like just under 30 tags that get added to an RSS file. It's nothing proprietary or sneaky. All of it is just XML, and you just add these tags to the XML file, and the podcasting tutorial clients know what to do with it. But one last thing, the bit of brilliance about the boost that is a game changer for the podcasting ecosystem is there is the concept of splits and fees. So when you boost in, for example, we have a split that goes to editor Drew and myself and the network fund, which then we kick back to Mike and the production costs and all of that. But additionally, there is a fee concept. So like a 1% fee of the boost goes to the creator of the app. Now, this is a big deal because it monetizes the app for the developer without them having to like side slam in some kind of crazy monetization scheme, maybe like, you know, ads in the app or a membership that's super crazy expensive, or some of them might have to have that because it's a big job. But the idea is to make it sustainable and possible for the developer to work on making a great app because they also get a cut of this boost ecosystem. That's never been done in podcast apps before. The developers that create these podcast apps have always had to come up with a system to monetize that app to make it possible outside of all of this. And now we have a native way to do it. While you're supporting the production of this show, you're also supporting the podcasting 2.0 ecosystem, including the index and the developer of the app that you're boosting from. That's huge for making sure that these developers can put food on their table and that these projects become sustainable for them. It's a system that's never been available for in podcasting, and that's why when you boost, you're not only supporting this show, but you're also supporting an ecosystem of developers. We really do appreciate it. Thank you, boosters and streamers. You are the best. We have links at the top of the show notes if you'd like the easy way to get started. And of course, a thank you to our Coder QA crew. I think we have like 2 more, 3 more redemptions of that crazy Jar Jar code that somebody slipped in there, and you can take $2 a month off for the lifetime of your membership. Coder.show/membership for that. Mr. Dominic, is there anywhere you want to send the good people before we get out of here?
Go to alice.dev if you need some stuff automated. I do have some availability now, so if you need any kind of like mobile or Rails or Python, let me know.
Business?
Yeah. I think we may be recording a double next week because I'll be traveling. So we'll be live on the 9th of April, and I think we're going to do a back-to-backer. So if you want to come in for a nice long live stream next week, that'd be the one for it. We don't actually have this on paper yet, but that's kind of what we've been discussing. So that's, I'm putting that out there now. I'll try to remember to update jupiterbroadcasting.com/calendar. But you can always just kind of know what's going on if you follow me on Weapon X at Chris LES, because pretty much all I tweet about is when the shows go live. I mean, not 100%, but 80%. And then it's at Coda Radio Show if you want to follow the show itself. Links to what we talked about today. Oh, I'm so glad you asked. Those are at coder.show/564. You'll find our RSS feed over there. You'll find our contact form over there as well. And our previous episodes, which you can, I don't know, binge. Binge them. This is a value for value production. If you got some value for it, please consider becoming a member or boosting in. We have details that on our website as well. All right. That wraps us up for this episode of the Coda Radio. I hope to see you next week when we're live on Tuesday at noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern over at jblive.tv. If not, enjoy the download. We always appreciate you listening. And we'll see you right back here next week.